on the basis of some readings from the novel O God, which many of you perhaps have seen in its movie form, a movie directed by Carl Reiner, starring George Burns as God and John Denver as the man who is finessed into an interview with God. On the basis of the novel written by Avery Corman, we're attempting to ask some theological questions. And the two resource people that we have asked to engage the question that we put each day directly are Walt Bowman and Wolfgang Roth. They have done no preparation for this, except that their whole life has been preparation for it. I have just, in contrast to yesterday, given them the question that I want to put this morning, and I'll give that to you in just a bit. But we're asking them to each discuss it at length, whatever length each chooses, and then to engage one another in conversation over it, as they will. And then we want to take some time at the end, of course, to involve us all and to invite us all into the conversation. The question I want to ask today is somewhat different from the question we put yesterday, but I won't be surprised if there is considerable continuity from the discussion that was begun then, and those of you who were here yesterday will undoubtedly recognize much of that. Now, I'd like to indicate what the question is before I do the readings today, rather than after them, and perhaps that will help us all to hear the readings in the light of them. The fundamental question is, how is God involved in the world today? How is God involved in the world today? Is he, as some say, dead? Is he, as others say, and as is suggested in the reading, retired? Or to use a different metaphor and one that occurs in the reading, is he sitting in the stands rooting for us, a spectator of it all? In contrast to all that, is he perhaps an absolute monarch who has decided and determined all the outcomes and all the issues that you and I wrestle and struggle with? I think the counterpart to that set of questions is the question, what is the truth about human freedom? What is the extent of human freedom? Now, I think we experienced yesterday, some of you commented that this is one of the times when we can become more philosophical than at other parts in our village program. And I simply want to say, as some of you said to me yesterday, I really think that's okay. I don't want to discourage that. I think there's a use for that, and I think that ought to appear somewhere in our village program. On the other hand, the questions that I've put, I think, are intensely practical. And if they haven't broken open with their full meaning and value for you just in my putting them, I hope they will in the reading that I am about to do. And my hope is that the conversation of our two resource people and all of our conversation together may shed considerable practical light on those questions. Now I'll read a few sections about what God has come to say through John Denver. I'm not going to recapitulate the story. I think most of you are familiar with it, and if you're not, you'll perhaps get the idea, and I'll be glad to talk to you in more detail about it after. Some of you noted that there is some divergence from the movie that you saw. Some of the very enjoyable scenes in the movie are not in the book. The one that comes to mind is the one where God is challenged to prove his power by making it rain. And so he makes it rain, but only in the automobile of the skeptic, because he doesn't want to ruin everyone's day. So the car is going down the highway and water is just gushing out of it while the sun is shining and the cars are driving behind wondering what's going on up there. Well, might cause some people to say, oh God. I'll tell you why I'm doing this, he said. They've been going around saying I'm dead or worse. What's worse? That I never was, or what I was gas or schmutz. Schmutz? You know, particles. With the Big Bang theories and the Little Bang theories, when you're God, it's insulting. He was confiding in me. Let's stop right here. I really think you should be talking to somebody higher up. The Pope, maybe. No, I looked into this, and you're my fella. I'm his fella. What if I don't ask the right questions? What if I misquote him? A misquote here could have cosmic significance. Excuse me, what do I call you? Call me God. God, I think I should have a tape recorder. Forget it, it wouldn't work. Why? My voice, it wouldn't come out on the tape. I don't understand. I can't get into it, it's very complex. It's like, what would you understand? Ghosts? You know how they used to say a ghost was not supposed to cast a shadow? Well, it's like that. You can't record God's voice. I really don't understand. Oi, 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 he said. Because it's not my real voice. I'm just making this up for you, so you can hear it. I mean, I'm God over everybody. But I'm not speaking Chinese, am I? Actually, you sound a little Jewish. What then? You're a little Jewish, aren't you? Yes? So, like I'm telling you, I'm doing this for you. By the way, I was at your bar mitzvah. It didn't knock me out. You were there? I'm there for everything. Prayers, weddings, bar mitzvahs, funerals, baptisms, you name it. The Pledge of Allegiance to the flag with that under God thing in it. I'm there. A fella stubs his toe and says, God damn it. I'm there. Kate Smith sings God Bless America. I'm there. For everything? Everywhere on earth, anytime anyone invokes the name of God? I'm there. I got to cover a lot of territory in my work. That's an incredible concept. That's something man has wanted to know for centuries. Are prayers heard? Does God listen? Who says I listen? I only said I'm there. After a while, who can listen? Then God doesn't care. I care. I care plenty. But what can I do? But you're God. Only for the big picture. What? I don't get into details. Why? It's better that I shouldn't meddle. What am I going to do? Get into favorites? So I come up with the concepts, the big ideas. The details can take care of themselves. Then the way things happen on Earth, they happen. Don't look at me. And there's no plan, no scheme that controls our destinies? A lot of it is luck. Luck and you know who. I was staggered. He just went zipping along. Looking back, of course, I made a few mistakes. Giraffes. It was a good thought, but it really didn't work out. Avocados. On that, I made the pit too big. Then there are things that work pretty good. Photosynthesis is a big favorite of mine. Spring is nice. Tomatoes are cute. Also, raccoons. But what about man? I was trying to rise to the responsibility. What about his future? The future of the planet? It's a good question. And? I couldn't tell you. Don't you know? Well, like I say, I don't get into that. Of course, I hope you make it. I mean, I'm a real fan. But it's like in a ball game. If you're in the stands, you can root. But that's about all. You're God. You can protect our future, alleviate suffering, work miracles. I don't do miracles. They're too flashy, and they upset the natural balance. Oh, maybe I'll do a miracle now and then, just for fun, if it's not too important. The last miracle I did was the 1969 Mets. And before that, the 1914 Boston Braves. And before that, I think you have to go back to the Red Sea. But as God, you have the power to intervene, to help us in emergencies. So where do I draw the line? Say a fella is going to eat a hamburger that's not 100% beef. What do I do? Knock it out of his hand? How would you like to live with divine hands popping out of the sky all the time? It would make people crazy. But I'm talking about wars and poverty and health. That's not on the level of hamburgers. That depends on where you sit. So you've decided to just let us stumble along and never do a thing to help. You got to understand, I went through my manipulative, controlling stage. You know what I mean from manipulative? It was back in the Ten Commandments days. Now I had it in mind there should be about 5,000 commandments to cover every eventuality. Things like, thou shalt pick up the trash from the picnic areas. Thou shalt help old ladies to cross the road, unless you're an old lady, in which case you should watch good. Like that. Then I changed my mind and did a rewrite. I got it down to about 800 commandments. But even that was a little cumbersome, so I rewrote again and got it down to 100. And then all the way down to 15. Only Moses told me, they'll never sit still for 15 commandments. Make it 8. And I said, 12. And he said, 9. And I said, 10. And he said, sold. But he was wrong anyway. They don't even sit still for 10. Well, you may think we've disappointed you, but you've disappointed us. Imagine me coming on to him that way. But somehow I found the nerve and I had to say it. How can you permit the suffering that goes on in the world? I don't. You do, he said. You're not involved. Listen, I keep up. I know what's going on. Of course, I don't read enough. I mean, nonfiction I never read because, after all, I know everything. Fiction I could read more of. But mostly I prefer television. You watch television? Well, the news I don't watch because nothing on the news is news to me. Flip Wilson I like. He puts on a zippy show. Sports I watch, except baseball. I don't like too much on television. It's better in the ballpark. I'm having a lot of trouble focusing on what it is you do. That's just it. Most of what I do, I did. I created the world, which is something. In 6 days, I work very fast. But now I just sort of watch over it. I guess you can say, in a sense, I'm retired. Right. Exactly what a lot of people feel today. God is retired, absent, dead, the same thing. It's not. Retired means I'm around, only I'm not as active. Look at it this way. In the old days, I had a lot more to do setting things up. That's why I put in so many more appearances back then. Now I sit, I watch, I take a walk. You take a walk? In the metaphysical sense. Don't try to understand it. But I see everything, I listen to everything. Even the new music, I can't get no satisfaction. Also, while I'm on this topic, there was one popular song a while back about believing that for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. Well, I want to straighten that out while I'm here. There is some rain that just falls, It just falls. It has nothing to do with flowers. I was in way over my head, was I ever, but I was trying to organize in my mind what he was saying. Well, it seems to me if you're not as active as you once were, maybe that's why people are losing faith. So that's why I'm here. I'm a little worried. People today, they'll worship who knows what. Like I used to think maybe they'd end up worshiping a car. God would be the 1940 Lincoln Continental. Now I sometimes think it could be an experience, like flying first class to Hawaii, eating a steak, or watching a movie. That could be a God thing. Yes, but looking at it from our standpoint, frankly, how much more are you offering? Listen to him. I got myself a real ipsy-pipsy here. What I mean is, God finally reveals himself in our time, and what is his message? I'm not too active, so why don't you stumble along? I hope you make it. Such a smart fella, and you missed the point. Now write this down, word for word, so nobody else should miss it. The thing is, to use the expression, God lives. This is important. If God was dead or never was, then you should be plenty worried because you wouldn't know if what you got can even work. But God is here and he's giving you a guarantee. I'm telling you that I set all this up for you and made it so that it can work. Only the deal is, you have to work at it, and you shouldn't look to me to do it for you. So, that's not hopeful? Possibly. Possibly, he gives me. Go, tell them what I said. God says they got everything they need. It's all built in. And on that, I give my word. I wrote it down, word for word. And make sure the story gets placed good so lots of people will read it, he said. It was apparent the interview was over. I didn't know what was appropriate to say. Do you say, Amen? I said, Thank you. That's all right. I'll tell you what, you've been such a good fella, I'll give you a little personal advice. Your last play. It's not bad, but you got third act trouble. If you cut a little from Act 2 and combine it with Act 3 and make it a two-act play, you'll have something good. Listen to me. I know from this. The big thing is not how I say it, but what I'm saying. And I think I can communicate with more people by talking this way than with fancy words like cosmological and ontological, which, believe you me, I know how to use. So what I'm really saying to the world is, I'm here, and it can work, and I root for you, and I like you a lot, and try not to hurt each other. What is going to happen here? You're asking me? You don't know? How could I know? You're God. You know everything. I know everything from before. I know everything from now. I don't know anything from what's going to be. You really don't know? The future? Not a prayer. Not even what's going to happen tomorrow? Not even what's going to happen for dinner. That's astounding. Why so? I know what is. How can I know what isn't? I didn't realize you had any limitations. So write a paper on it. You can be a big philosopher if you don't feel you're big enough. If you don't know, who does? Nobody I know. When I first interviewed you and I asked you about the future of the planet, you said you didn't get into that. I don't. But it never occurred to me that you really didn't know. Don't think I'm not interested. But if you don't even know where the world is headed, that's very disturbing. That's the way it is. But why did you come to us now? Why now? This must have been a warning. You must know something. I know everything, but not that. But is the world in a crisis? Is something imminent? Sure, you're in a crisis. Everything's imminent. You didn't know that? I knew that. One day I called the house from a phone booth on 42nd Street. The phone rang back and I picked it up. Hello, it's me, God. Hello, where are you? In the next booth. There he was, standing right next to me on the phone and looking much cheerier than when I saw him last. Too many people around, he said. It would be suspicious if somebody recognized you. They'd notice you first, I said. He was wearing a safari hat, a bush jacket, jodhpurs, and boots, none of which fit him. I'm going on a little trip to spend some time with animals. I like animals, and sometimes I don't spend enough time. Are you all right? I was worried about you. You think God can't take care of himself? I wondered where you were. I don't have to account. The fact is, I was making up my mind. And what should I do next? Nothing. What do you mean? I mean, there's nothing to do. I came to say goodbye. Goodbye? Are you going just for now? For now and for later. You're not coming back? No. That's what I decided. I did what I came to do. Didn't work out as good as I wanted, but those who want to believe, so they'll believe, and the others, so they won't. I got a few people to think about things, though. That's pretty good. He waved at me through the glass. So that's it. Take care, Bubale. I'll be watching. But you can't go. It's time already. You can't. It's time. But there are things I should be asking you. We did all that. And there must be things you want me to do. No. There must be something. Well, you're a writer. Why don't you write about it? He was really going. It's too soon, I said. I think we got some pretty good business done. I don't mean only that. I was just getting to know you. I mean, our relationship was just beginning. These days, relationships are very difficult. Sometimes, now and then, couldn't we just talk? I'll tell you what. You talk. I'll listen. And then he threw me a little kiss, and he walked away. He was gone. It was over, just like that. I never saw him again. I've thought a lot since then about the whole experience, and I thought it would be great if I could sum it up in one profound, magical paragraph that says it all. I couldn't. I tried to write it so many times, I lost count. The best I can offer on my feelings about him is this. I wish we could have gotten closer. How is God involved in the world? Is he dead? Is he retired? Is he sitting in the stands, rooting for us? Or on the other hand, is he an absolute monarch who has all the issues of our life already determined, and you and I are like puppets just living them out? What's the truth about human freedom? What's the extent of human freedom? What does Christianity have to say about all that? Walt, maybe you want to begin today.
I was telling Phil beforehand that my professional job is to be a theoretician of Christianity. Not everybody has to be a theoretician, and you can have good and valid and important and necessary experiences of Christianity, and you can live out Christianity without theory. But somebody has to attend to theory, and so I'm one of the people who does that. I guess that's why it gets philosophical. When we listen to a story like that, we have a lot of smiles about the kinds of questions that he raises and the kind of conversation that he has. But I wanted to read just a couple of quotations from Elie Wiesel's book, Night, in which he experiences Jews in large numbers in concentration camps. The moment they arrived, his mother and his young sister were separated from his father and himself. They went straight to the gas chambers and to the ovens. He and his father were put into a work battalion. And so one of the things he writes is, I shall never forget these things, even if I am condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. And then on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, as the thousands of men gathered for the prayers and had fasted, Wiesel wrote this, "What are you, my God, compared to this afflicted crowd proclaiming to you their faith, their anger, their revolt? What does your greatness mean, Lord of the universe, in the face of all this weakness, this decomposition, this decay? Why do you still trouble their sick minds and their crippled bodies? This day I cease to plead. I was no longer capable of lamentation. On the contrary, I felt very strong. I was the accuser and God the accused. My eyes were open and I was alone, terribly alone, in a world without God and without man, without love, without mercy. I had ceased to be anything but ashes. Yet I felt myself to be stronger than the Almighty, to whom my life had been tied for so long. And I stood amid that praying congregation, observing it like a stranger." I think what religion does for many of us is to have us operate with a picture as if the whole of the human enterprise were some vast puppet show and God the puppeteer. And with our religious activities, then, we would be able to make him manipulate the strings in some way that it would come out to our benefit. And when it doesn't work that way, when it does not come out to our benefit, when horrible, terrible things happen, like millions of Jews simply being herded into concentration camps and killed, or like our own lives going in directions that we do not want and cannot understand, then we say, God, you have failed us, or religion doesn't work, or we'll find something that works better, we'll find another religion that works better, but we're still operating within that picture. I guess I want to say two things to that. The first thing is, if we look for God in the structures of the world, in the way the world works, then we are going to meet a God who is either ambiguous or terrifying as all hell. And I'm not trying to be profane. The ambiguities confront us in the fact that some days really are better than others. John preached on that a couple of Sundays ago, and it's become almost a kind of slogan in Holden. Some days really are better than others. There are good days and bad days. Which day is the day to decipher God's will, to decide whether he's on your side or not, whether he is for you or against you? Are you supposed to read him off of the good days or off the bad days, off the good experiences or off the bad? You know, the waters of a lake can be placid and calming, and they can be stormy and terrifying. The mountains can be beautiful to look at, and they can be deadly and destructive. Nature can be soothing, and it can turn on us. Which of these are we to use to interpret God and us? Well, answer, if we're going to look there, it'll either be ambiguous, that is, we don't know, or that we will get mixed signals, or it will be terrifying, deadly, because the last word that the natural processes say to every one of us is, you will die. And the last word of God from the natural structures is a burial, a funeral. The death rate is one per person. Now, the question then is, where do we look for God's way of being in the world? Biblical record tells us, I think, that we look for God's way of being in the world through us, through people. God chooses to be in the world through people. And he shapes events in such a way that they become landmarks or shaping marks for people functioning in the world as God's agents. The Genesis story says that God asks us to name everything, but to name it means already to have some power over it. We are the ones who name the raccoons, the chipmunks, the rabbits, the mountains. I don't think they name themselves. We do. We have a certain control when we name. We are called into partnership with God. The way we use that partnership, however, has been devastating and deadly to a lot of our world. We destroy these chipmunks, sometimes even with the very kindnesses that we perpetrate, but we affect our world also by deadly things, by poisons, by fission bombs, and so on. So God calls a people into existence, calls them into existence with the Exodus, teaches them through the events that happen to them so that they reflect on these events. And you can see how Israel's own experience of God develops through its own reflection on its life history. And finally, God sets up in the midst of the people a sign of his own lasting and unconditioned commitment to us, the sign of the death and resurrection of Jesus. We do not say God is Jesus. We really do say it the other way around. Jesus and what happens in him is the way we are supposed to think about God, about ourselves, and about our world. It's true, I think, that God really does not know what we will do tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, or next year. In that sense, the resurrection of Jesus tells us only one thing, that the final outcome of history is comic. That is, it's going to end well. What's going to happen in between is not farce, but comedy. That is, it can have a lot of tragic things happening in between. But the cross and the resurrection of Jesus, if they become our mark, our symbol, the symbol and the mark of the people of God, can shape our way of being in the world so that we, literally, we human beings who are marked with the cross and the resurrection of Jesus, are the means of grace, the means of God's action in the world. So when we pray, we are not asking God to manipulate the world for our benefit. That would be treating the world as if it were a casino, and hoping with our prayers to hit the jackpot every once in a while. No, instead, when we pray, what we are really asking is how we can become the instruments and the agents of the grace of God shaped by the story, the event of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. And prayer, therefore, I guess Bonnie read it in Matins this morning. Prayer really means the whole of our lives lived out as if the cross and the resurrection of Jesus were life-shaping for us, as if we could be, as if we could be givers and not takers, as if we could be vulnerable and not tyrants over one another, as if we could be redeemers and not destroyers. That's the way God works in the world, and I don't think he works any other way graciously except through us. I'll quit.
Thank you.
That's my theory, all right?
Okay. Well, I suppose I have to take off my hat, so to speak, as a literary historian of the ancient Hebrew scriptures and related things, and have to put on the hat that Walter has too, namely that of a reflecting theologian. These are the questions that Phil formulated. How is God involved in the world? As a starter, of course. Is he, if not dead, retired? Is he just a spectator who roots for us? Or is he an absolute monarch? Listen to the questions again, but now I slightly rephrase them. How is the human being involved in God? Is it, if not dead, retired from God? Is it just a spectator who roots for God? Or is it an absolute monarch that determines what is? That's the way in which I would have phrased the question, by the way. But I couldn't have, had he not first phrased them this way. Okay. When I look at the Hebrew scriptures and then at the New Testament, at the early Jewish writings, I perceive a dynamic, a constant change. I perceive these ancient Hebrews and then the early Christians again and the early Jews, and in a way that continues through the history of the synagogue and the church, what you could call with a somewhat abstract term, reconceiving their religious tradition. In other words, under new challenges, in new situations, radically new, partly new, and sometimes they were radically new, sometimes they were partly new, finding that the way in which their religious commitment manifested itself, was spelled out yesterday, is no more good today. It has died. And they had the courage to acknowledge that, and yet, on the other hand, didn't give up on it altogether. They had the courage to reformulate, sometimes radically, their faith. So much so that violent debate arose between them, each claiming that the other party is a traitor to the faith. Now, of course, you can read that out also from the history of the church, that this has happened more than once. Now I perceive it to be laid upon me not to repeat parakeet-like the formulations of faith and doctrine or prayers that I encounter in the Hebrew scriptures or the New Testament. I know them quite well, or at least I study them all the time, and I delight in this. But they are constantly for me an invitation not to turn them into absolutes, not to make them into idols. Or, as someone said once, you cannot turn the milestones of a pilgrimage into absolutes. They remain milestones that mark the way and, by implication, mark the direction in which the pilgrimage moves. But woe to those who wish to return to the milestones of their journey. Or, I could also say somewhat more nastily, to the leech and the cucumbers, and the good things in the flesh pots of Egypt. Now this means that it is laid upon us today to reconceive in integrity, and I will have to say something about the word integrity here in a moment, the Christian tradition. Now I think that this can be done in different ways. if I sort of survey the contemporary scene among Christians for whom this work of theory, as Walter has described it, is their vocation, and they have been called by others to do this for them and with them, as Walter, of course, is doing it, and others are doing it too, then I can see various options. I find very intriguing one way of reconceiving the thrust of the Christian tradition, and that is in terms of God, if, and this is the first time I'm using this word, by the way, being born time and again in a movement from a beginning to an end. It is the way in which somewhat like Teilhard de Chardin, and I know of some Indian counterparts, Indian Christian counterparts to him, are doing it. So that even in this conversation here that we are having around this fireplace, God happens. God occurs. In fact, I would move further, that for us, here and now, this group, only there, in this encounter, God occurs. This, I think, is one option that is taken by many. It has constituted a group of Christians that operate within this. In the scholarly meetings of the American Academy of Religions, you have task forces that deal with it. And you have a large community, some of my colleagues at the seminary where I teach, who speak within these parameters and speak this language. I'm beginning to learn it. I am not sure it would be the one in which I could, at least for myself and for others whom I perceive to be with me in this respect, reconceive the Christian tradition. But let me move away now somewhat from these more abstract considerations and conclude with a reference to the reading of the book. Probably it has either annoyed you or amused you when earlier on, Phil, in Phil's reading, the assertion was made that every time the name of God is mentioned, God is there. Now, we by definition would say, well, yeah, he is there, or we hope he is there, when we address him reverently in prayer, or when in a dogmatic statement, or in a liturgical statement, or a theological statement, that name occurs. But if someone says, God damn it, heavens no, he is not there by definition. Or if someone says, seeing a Volkswagen drive down the road in broad sunshine and water pouring out of it, as it was in the movie, if someone responds to it, in this case Phil Schroeder, oh God, is he there too? Now I would say, yes, indeed. How is he there? And I think he is there in the sense that here God has become the cipher for the principal openness, in this case of Phil Schroeder, to seeing in this odd thing, a Volkswagen driving down the road in broad sunshine with water pouring out of it, not just a curiosity or something that you shrug off, but it becomes a cipher for your openness to recognize the boundaries of our human existence and, lo and behold, not to let them become prison walls. It becomes a cipher for human openness, and that ultimately, I think, means for a stance that does not turn the human being into an absolute that idolizes itself. And if you now listen again, how is the human being involved in God? Is it, if not dead, retired? Is it just a spectator who roots for God? Or is it an absolute monarch that defines all things?
Is God there and is God here because we're talking about him and because we're naming his name?
Yeah, you see, now I would simply put it in the other way around. I would say, in the openness we experience in this circle, that we do not simply exhaust ourselves in repeating well-known formulas, but dare to open windows to entertain something that can be either reassuring or frightening or annoying. There I perceive, that I would name God, along the line that Walter has described it. If we name everything, do we also name God and he so comes into being?
See, I think that the cross and the resurrection as a shaping event is precisely that which opens us. See, the cross is the symbol of ultimate vulnerability, which is ultimate openness. And the resurrection is a way of saying that that ultimate vulnerability is, in fact, God's way of being present and redemptive in the world. And because the opposite of that, the opposite of the cross, is protection. Those who did it to Jesus were doing it to protect the tradition, the state, the system, whatever. And that's closed. That's the opposite of being shaped by the cross. It is also to place ourselves in opposition to God's way of being redemptive in the world. But tragically, it looks almost as if it's the reverse. It is the people, I come out of the Missouri Synod, it's no secret, it is the people who want to protect the past, who invoke the name of God to do that, who paradoxically are doing just the opposite. But they are the winners, and they almost always are the winners. And so it looks as if that is the way God is present in the world. See, we won, therefore God is on our side. I think that if we are shaped by the cross, it is almost the reverse. We have lost, therefore God is on our side. Or we have lost in taking the risk, in being open.
In speaking about being open, I'm wondering where the Mormons would be. What should we think about their openness to God?
Well, recently, I must say, a miracle has happened. Lax can now be among the elected few. I rejoice. Maybe that's a miracle. Maybe that she should be added to Oh God.
I'm thinking particularly about adding to the biblical.
Oh, in that sense. And,
are they, I think we have to question, mm-hmm. are they more open to God?
Because they have added on to the biblical corpus?
Yeah. We don't think so, but
well, I rejoice in the one flower that has blossomed there and am happy. And go on to look for more flowers.
It would seem as if there has to be some principle of discrimination between over what is added on, because one could add on some very false kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Accretions, and that God could be active and powerful among us in our rejecting of that which is false or that which is contradictory. So it's not simply openness, it's not simply adding on represents that.
When we talk about God active through people, is he active through all people?
I would say yes, but not redemptively.
Oh, okay, because I want to follow with a question. For example, when, just before we came up, read in the paper with this young 15-year-old boy in New York, had real thrills watching, being able to stand and put a gun alongside somebody's head in the subway and kill them. That was real exciting for him. He said it really just really turned him on to see that person really literally blown. And the question comes to me, is God acting through that young man's life? And you would say he is, but not redemptively.
God made people different from animals. Animals do not build hydrogen bombs. Animals do not blow people's heads off in the subway. Animals live instinctually, which is to say they do not operate with the range of choices and possibilities that are open to us. I can imagine God delighting to be with animals for a while instead of with us. I don't know who wrote Gentleman's Agreement, Catherine Lacey, I think. It's a book about Jewish prejudice out of my own college years, which is now a long time ago, 30 years almost. In Gentleman's Agreement, one of the heroines says that when she has been hurt very badly by people, she goes off to her garden in Connecticut and works with her flowers because they do not hurt back. So I can imagine God taking a great delight in animals and inanimate creation because it can't hurt him, that is, despoil his purposes the way we can. The possibilities in human existence include, however, not only blowing people's heads off, but writing the Beethoven symphonies and performing them, writing the great poems, writing the great plays and novels, all the wellsprings of human creativity, singing the songs that were in the Village Center last night. I'm exhilarated by those kinds of things, but the mechanism of exhilaration that produces and performs and enjoys the symphonies and the songs is also the same mechanism in its perverted state that can get its thrills out of blowing people up in subways. It's the same mechanism. That's what's so deadly. So that for God to enjoy the Messiah, he has to bear with the boy in the subway. All right? And it isn't only that he watches both. He created the art forms in the parables and suffered the boy in the subway on the cross. And I think that alone helps me to make sense out of the human experiment, which is what we still are, and which is why, validly in that book, God does not yet know what will become of us. The means for our becoming what he intends are there. But the risk is, and it is a real risk, that we will blow it. And we do. I had this terrible feeling. First time I held my oldest son in my arms in the hospital in Mankato, I just had a moment of terrible dread that I was not able to get rid of for a long time. Because here was a human life for which I was half responsible, and the outcome of which was not given in his just being there, but in what we would do over the next decade and more. That's, you know, and you don't know. And I do not know yet. We have fine sons, and I love them all. And they are doing things that make us very proud of them. But I keep saying, it isn't over yet, and I don't know. And we are very close to what God is like when he made human beings, when we make human beings. And that's a terrible risk, and it's a great exhilarating moment. And that's the way it is. Yes, so I think God is involved in everything, and to say, oh no, only in the good things, is to miss the point. But if we do not read the totality of that involvement out of the central symbol of the cross and resurrection, then we are going to go absolutely mad contemplating Beethoven and a subway murderer as belonging to the same species.
Let me push this a little bit further. I like Twalt's approach. It is not yet said whether God will work redemptively through this horrible event. I'm sure he will not work redemptively through it, in and through people who file it away as one more deplorable instance mm-hmm. of the horrible big city from which I'm far removed, rurally or in the safe suburb. I'm sure then not. Through human beings for whom this is one further call of God to realize the dimensions of evil, estrangement, alienation among us individually and corporately, and who see this as one further invitation, as far as in them lieth, to overcome it in their own interhuman relationship. Who knows? God may once again, as some of the scripture writers said, St. Augustine said, bring good out of evil. So, the response lies in you and you and me to your question, which is the question to be asked.
Isn't this our opposition to capital punishment? I mean, those that are opposed to capital punishment, the hope of redemption.
That's certainly one of the arguments often advanced, yes, and I remember once being in a debate.
And not only for the criminal, the redemption, but also for us. There were other hands, aren't we?
Back here?
I don't know what it was typing.
I guess I was thinking of that quotation from Joseph when his brothers discovered that he was the ruler of Egypt, and then they began to be afraid of what he might do to them. And thinking of their own sin against him, selling him off to slavery. And he says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good.
Right.
Just a note, if I'm sure if we did not have evil, we wouldn't be as much aware, of course, that God is there. We would have more profound faith in our faith than faith in God. In other words, we're just in a circle of times when we have so much good.
May I ask each of you to address, perhaps briefly, you've done it somewhat indirectly, but very directly, the question of how each of us might well think of our human freedom, a decision that I have to make today. Maybe it's a career decision, maybe it's a marital decision, maybe it's a family decision of some sort. What God is up to, what God is wanting to be about in that very situation of human freedom.
Is the extent of human freedom, you say?
How might go ahead.
The responsibility on it. Turn to how your question came to me.
The responsibility of we're not condemned violence. We live by mercy. We have to make decisions, and we do them, and we make mistakes. We have to live under mercy, not trust. In that process, reading the gospel of all that, praying that when we do make the mistakes, that God will use it for good, that we'll be instruments of redemption, not of threat and not of destruction, I guess.
Is God a spectator of my deciding? Is he rooting for me? Is that the extent of it?
I had mixed feelings on that one. Because I know that this idea of freedom, indeed, he has given to them. But sometimes I have to think that he does become directly involved. But I get carried away to this process and say that everything happens to that thing. I think about King Hezekiah praying for his life. and God apparently changed his mind and said that it fits you now.
I guess we have the freedom to decide what we should do, what we should choose, but also we reap the consequences. And that way God teaches us to grow mature. Does it make any sense?
Yes, it sounds at best like the spectator role.
No.
Pulling for me, hoping for me, but really removed from the process. Maybe I missed.
No, more like a father, I think. Yeah. More like a father. I think spectator wouldn't be the best description here. Isn't it more like a father?
A liberal father.
A liberal father.
I would say like the coach of an athletic team who has done his best to shape the quality of the team, and he then has to let the outcome of the game take its course. Only God's coaching takes the form of the cross and resurrection again. And we rehearse the plays in the liturgy. That's what we come together for. And then hope that that will happen in the concrete living out of our being the people of God and the body of Christ in the world.
The biblical image of his spirit striving with our spirits comes to mind in this connection. God as the one who is in some way dynamically present in this which is going on, not overruling our human freedom, but indeed providing for it and undergirding it and supporting it. But that's a different feel to me, the sense of God as spirit striving with my spirit, which is struggling with very real decisions and outcomes.
I'm sure that Phil is aware of the fact that he has asked one of the most difficult questions, because I hear already the writers of sacred scripture struggling with it. Martin Luther has a beautiful formulation which shows the difficulty. A human being is a free human being over all things and subject to nobody. And then he says, a human being is the servant of everybody and subject to everybody. Mm-hmm. Well now, 100% freedom and 100% non-freedom. Mm-hmm. 100% lordship and 100% servanthood. Well now, what you see here is, in this case, Luther struggling with your question and saying, I cannot neatly divide it out into 50%, 50%, 25%, 25%, or before and after. It is a constant with each other and in part against each other, and you cannot divide it out that way. Yeah. Ben Sira, which I'm reading just now, has a long dissertation on it, evidently that troubled people in the year 200 BCE. And he really, while he lays out the problem very well, comes out with a poor solution. He says, on the one hand, God is the cause of everything. Yes, that I have to maintain. On the other hand, I cannot understand the human being to be a puppet in God's hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now what do I do with it? Yeah, we're familiar with it. Or look at this formulation of Paul, where he says in Philippians at the end of the second chapter, do all you can to accomplish your own salvation. That's a straightforward command, imperative, which implies that you can do it. What else would be the point in giving you a command? And then he continues, for it is God who works in you both, the willing and the completing. I'm freely translating. Well now what's what here? But again, you see, Paul also can only answer the question, as we say in technical language, dialectically, by making two statements which seem to exclude each other and yet have to be taken side by side. This is not an answer, it's simply pointing out what a difficult question you have asked us.
But I think it is the, you know, it's a very helpful pointer toward an answer.
Mm-hmm.
God is at work in you both to will and to do his good pleasure. God is at work, and I take that working to be from what Walt said about the death and the resurrection of Christ. It is through that, through the suasion of that, through the Spirit that emanates from that, that God really is dynamically present among us, and that our opening ourselves to that is not to open ourselves to something unreal, magical, or anything that makes our human freedom only a charade, only something that appears but is not really so. Let me conclude by thanking Walt and Wolfgang and all of you. We set these two sessions to be conversations on God. I think they have been that. We have not exhausted the subject. That ought not surprise us. The sentence on which the book ends, I read to you, "I wish we could have gotten closer." I think the good news is we can. Thank you.